Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Madeline Miller, author of Circe, published just last week by Lee Boudreau Books, which is an imprint of Little Brown. Madeline's previous work, The Song of Achilles, was awarded the Orange Prize for Fiction, I think back in 2012. Her essays have appeared in many periodicals, including The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, Lapham's Quarterly, one of my favorite magazines, and NPR. She also wrote a great Kindle single, which you should check out, Galatea, which, while set in a seemingly modern world, once again invokes what she can't seem to get rid of, the past and Greek myths. So Circe continues the story of Odysseus as he was included in The Song of Achilles, but now we're going to the Odyssey, and rather than focusing on him, the book centers around Circe, daughter of Helios, the sun god. Circe gets herself in all kinds of jams, including the precursor of magic, to transform her first love into a god who then rejects her, leading indirectly to the creation of Scylla, who, along with Charybdis, blocks the passage of sailors with horrible consequences. So now considered by her father and Zeus to be dangerous rather than just a nuisance, she's exiled to a remote island, the island where Odysseus lights upon on his journey and where his men are turned into wild pigs. So Circe kind of stands up to Athena and really the whole panoply of gods. She's kind of a superheroine and one with whom you emphasize and admire. But mixing power, goodness, and remorse is always a risky endeavor, and Madeline is able to do so in portraying Circe and her life. So welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Hello. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit, because I've read about a little bit about your background and how your childhood helped shape, I guess, both of these novels.
Yes. So my relationship to these stories goes back quite a long way. My mother used to read the Greek myths to me, and in particular, selections from the Iliad and the Odyssey, when I was a very young child, starting around age five. And she always thinks that makes her sound really inappropriate, but I loved it. I was obsessed with the myths and continued to study them. And when I got to high school, I was fortunate enough that I had a wonderful Latin teacher who said to me, you know, if you're really serious about this, I can have you reading Homer in a year in the original ancient Greek. And, you know, you could not have signed me up fast enough. And reading those myths and, you know, in particular the Iliad and the Odyssey in the ancient Greek was just a revelation. It was an overwhelming, beautiful, life-changing experience. And so I, you know, knew that I wanted to continue with classics. And I think I have just always really resonated and responded to these stories.
Did you ever have to convince your peer group that you were reading something that would be a lot of fun to read and they just couldn't get it?
Many times. I have one of my very, very best friends. She and I grew up together, almost like sisters, but she is not interested in the Greek myths. And she and I one time had a conversation where I was bubbling over with enthusiasm about the Iliad and the Trojan War. And she turned to me and she said, if you say the name Agamemnon one more time, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I sometimes did have to make the case, but she actually was very graciously, despite the fact that it does have Agamemnon in it, read Song of Achilles and called me up and said, you know, you convinced me, which was a very, very nice thing for her to do.
I think it convinced a lot of people because it brought it into the modern world, but you still, and without taking liberties. And so I think people, it's like, it just really gives you a chance to understand something you might not be able to otherwise. And I think part of that is because for whatever reasons, you know, you've been involved in this and engrossed in this for your entire life since you were a little kid.
Yes. Well, I, you know, one of the things that I feel really passionately about, particularly as a teacher, is that I wanted these myths to really be for everyone. I think in the ancient world, they absolutely were for everyone. You know, everyone knew these stories. It wasn't reserved for people who had particular educations. And so I really want them to that legacy to live on. You know, I don't want people to feel like they're homework. I don't want people to feel that they're shut out or that they, you know, can't understand it. You know, these are wonderful, wonderful stories. And so when people are coming to either Song of Achilles or Circe, I wanted them to be able to come to it with no knowledge of the Greek myths. But if they did know the Greek myths, hopefully there would be some goodies in there.
Yeah, even if they just vaguely recall, like, the story of Icarus and Daedalus, you know. But it's just like Shakespeare, you know, people, you know, think that Shakespeare is this highbrow thing when it was actually appealing to the groundlings, you know, just the general public.
Absolutely. There are some really, really lowbrow jokes in Shakespeare. Shakespeare is the other thing that I love. And, you know, there's a whole scene about, you know, that's just a series of penis jokes. I mean, really the whole scene.
Yeah, and then Falstaff, and then, well, even if you go back to the Canterbury Tales, you know, the same thing.
It's just, yes, exactly.
It's kind of like dirty stand-up comedy. It's like listening to Richard Pryor. I think you do, but do you have kids?
I do.
Do you read to them?
I do. I started reading, they're still fairly young, so I have not indoctrinated the 18-month-old yet. But my 3-year-old, who's almost 4, I do, you know, I show her some of the pictures from the Greek myths, I tell her the stories. And even, you know, even at this young age, she's gripped by them. Now, I will admit that I edit quite a bit. So, you know, in these versions that I'm telling her, no one ever dies. There's never really any blood. We just chase the monsters away. But, you know, even in that watered-down version, she is completely gripped, and she loves the stories. The Cyclops is particularly exciting to her.
Yeah, me too. I always felt sorry for the Cyclops. You know, Odysseus, you know, sometimes wasn't fair. He didn't really have to do some of the things he did.
Yes, well, you know, that's the thing about Odysseus is that a lot of times he gets into these bad situations that we feel so terrible, you know, for him, in because he wanted more loot. You know, the Cyclops thing is because he decided, yes, they needed help, they were looking for hospitality, but also he thought, here's a big cave filled up with stuff. And so he's drawn to things that might be treasure situations. So he was basically planning on ripping the Cyclops off.
Yeah. Hey, did you see the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I did.
That Cyclops scene in there was excellent, I thought.
Yes.
With John.
Well, and that's what's amazing, I think, about Homer is that, you know, you can look at him so many different ways through so many different lenses, and there's always something great there.
Well, actually, you know, I do this. I head off on tangents, but since we're trying to sell the book, seriously, tell us a little bit about her and how she was dealt her lot.
Yeah, so I was really drawn to the character of Circe because in the Odyssey, we see her as this powerful witch, this figure of menace who turns Odysseus's men into pigs. But we also see her in kind of the second half of the episode after she and Odysseus come to an understanding. She changes his men back from pigs back to men. She is very actually helpful, wise. She kind of becomes a patron to Odysseus. She's one of the most, you know, helpful deities that he encounters on his journey. And so I was interested in that complexity. But I think the thing that really brought me into her story is the fact that she is, although she's very powerful, she doesn't start out that way. She's a nymph. And, you know, we tend to think of the Greek gods as being all powerful in the same way, but it was an incredibly hierarchical system. And, you know, if you were at the top, if you were an Olympian, if you were Athena, or you were Zeus, or you were Helios, life was pretty good for you. But if you were a nymph, you were basically prey, not only to the greater gods, but including to mortals. And, you know, there's so many stories about nymphs being abused and raped. And so I was interested in looking at what it would be like to be a god, to have this immortality, but to not really have any power. And then Circe creates her own power because she discovers the power of witchcraft, which is separate from her divinity. It's something that she learns to do with herbs and poisons and her own will.
And that was one of the things that was very interesting, because I know I'm pronouncing this wrong, but you do use the, I guess it's a, maybe it's a Greek word, I don't know if it is or not, but the pharmacopoeia or pharmacopoeia, how is it pronounced?
Pharmaca or pharmakeia is witchcraft, and then pharmaca are the herbs.
So And then what was interesting to me was that she collected these herbs, she distilled them, she used the mortar and pestle, she created these potions and carried all the stuff around with her. But then at the very end, she had to have this little, you know, Peter Pan type of, not Peter Pan, who's the little witch in Disney? Not the witch, the imp.
Hermes?
No, I was thinking of the fairy. Never mind, it skipped my mind.
Okay. Tinkerbell.
Tinkerbell, yes. Like she waves her wand, there's a little sparkle, and that's what turns it into what it turns into. But then you have Penelope, when she comes to the island, begin to copy Circe's talents. And what she says is that the will to achieve the magic is a good portion of the magic itself. And
yes,
I never really thought about that.
Well, that was sort of, Circe is in Western literature the first witch, and so I got to have a lot of leeway in how I was imagining witchcraft, and I was drawing on the ancient sources, I was drawing on the Odyssey, but, you know, it was also kind of how I wanted to develop it, and it seemed to me that, you know, what happens is that she basically does it through force of will. And so it isn't something that is, you know, passed down through blood. It's something that people discover for themselves. Either they have it, they have the determination in them, or they don't. And I wanted witchcraft to be very much linked to hard work, that it's not, you know, a snap your fingers type thing. You know, it's not shooting fireballs out of your hands. It is this thing that you have to go out there and make it happen. And so I enjoyed that. And it was really fun. You brought up Penelope. It was so much fun to write Penelope, who is Odysseus's wife in the Odyssey. She's very clever, just as wily as Odysseus is. And knowing that she was going to be in the back half of the book was really fun.
Did that really happen in the Odyssey, Penelope and Circe getting together?
That is in the mythology. It's not in the Odyssey, but it is in a later epic cycle. We don't have the whole thing, but we have references to it and summaries of it, where she, we're heading into spoiler territory, but I never know, you know, is it a spoiler if it's a 3,000-year-old myth? It's always hard to know. So she does, in fact, come to Circe's island in a myth that's out there about Circe. So that was right from the mythology.
Well, I'm sorry if I did spoil it. I keep thinking it's...
No. Well, as I said, it's, you know, it's all out there.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was saying. I can't spoil it because it's been around for thousands of years. But
that's right.
But for example, you were mentioning, we were talking about the loom, but talk a little bit about, because it's this is something that everybody knows, is talk a little bit about Daedalus and Icarus, because you expand the father-son relationship and you also expand the talents, and then, of course, which I won't spoil, the relationship between Circe and Daedalus.
You know, Daedalus is a figure that I've always been interested in. He's kind of the first craftsman in the ancient world. He's kind of a Leonardo da Vinci character, inventor, artist, craftsman. And I was interested in him because he and Circe seemed like they were just on opposite sides of this line. She is a goddess who is almost human, and he is a human who has sort of these godlike powers in his ability to create things, but also because he is so notable, the gods are kind of drawn to him. So he has lived a lot of his life with gods taking an interest in him. So I think that they have something in common. I've always really liked Daedalus' story because it's so sad. It's really a parent's story. And there's a beautiful description of Daedalus in Virgil's Aeneid. It's just a very, very short section, but it always moves me, where, you know, they take the flight with Icarus. Icarus, of course, flies too close to the sun, tumbles into the waves. But Virgil's section focuses on Daedalus now making landfall. You know, he has to keep going and trying to shape the story in this, you know, work of art, and he can't bear to put the part about his son dying. And it talks about how, you know, three times he tried to fashion it, and his hands just kept falling. And so that grief, you know, a parent's grief at losing their child has always been very powerful to me.
And the other thing about it that was the way you shaped it was, in the story, I always thought of Icarus as being kind of stupid and prideful because his father warned him. But in this one, it's just almost like he's a really good kid, and he just happens, you know, he's so happy with what he can do. But it doesn't have that same feeling that, you know, he got what he deserved or anything. It's just like...
Yeah, that I think you're absolutely right that in the modern world, we've come to talk about sort of flying too close to the sun as being, as you say, an example of pride. But in the ancient story, I think he is often depicted as quite young, a young teenager, and just one mistake, but he carries the consequences for it, but the consequences are fatal. And so I think it's a very sad story.
And we were talking about, carrying these stories forward into present times. And if you think of Icarus's fate, it's not different than lots of kids' fates today because of one simple mistake that they didn't even know they were making.
Right, exactly.
Like take the opioid crisis or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's when you talked about Circe being a goddess, but wasn't the greatest thing in the world to be a nymph. She's very amenable to love or the act of love. And, she has these relationships. And she was lonely, right? I mean, she was looking for the same things that, any person, man or woman, would be looking for. And that surprised me as well. From her first encounter with Glaucus and then, with the other ones as well.
Yeah, well, I think what I was looking for, that is a key component of Homer's version of the Odyssey, of Odysseus's story, is that she, basically says to Odysseus, come into my bed, and the two of them are lovers, and he stays for a year, and they're lovers the whole time. And in fact, Odysseus doesn't even really want to go. His crew are sort of like, hey, it's been a year, don't you think it's time we took off? So that was a piece of her character, that she was drawn to him in a romantic way, in a sexual way, that was built into the story. But I think what I wanted is that Circe is pulled in two directions, because she really wants to define herself away from a lot of what she sees the gods doing. But she also wants to be close to people. And so I think she is caught in the reason she ends up being lonely for a lot of it is that she's looking for someone she can try and talk to, or who can understand her on her own terms. And she is she's only willing to go so far towards what she sees as kind of the poisonous atmosphere of the gods. In order to find that, so she ends up being alone for a lot of it. And what I really wanted this book to be for her is to mirror the story of Odysseus and the Odyssey. So Odysseus spends the whole Odyssey trying to get to Ithaca. The theme of the poem is Nostos, the longing for home, Nostos is homecoming, and then he longs for home the whole time. And I think Circe is doing the same thing. She's also longing for home and looking for home, but home is not so neat for her. It's not Ithaca. It's not a place that she can head towards. She sort of has to discover what that home is as well as finding it.
In Song of Achilles, Odysseus is like one of the most likable characters and kind of like an arbiter between two opposing forces. And I really liked him there. And in here, especially towards the end, things change. But it seemed to me like, and tell me if this is true, it's like when you were writing the parts about Odysseus, it seemed like you were almost nostalgic for Song of Achilles. It seemed like you were so happy to have him back. It just felt that way to me.
I was absolutely thrilled for the chance to revisit Odysseus. And it was really fun to revisit him from a very different time in his life. When we see him in Song of Achilles, he's young. We see him kind of before they go off to war, during the beginning of the war. But when Circe sees him, not only has he been through the extremely ugly sack of Troy, which we don't really, see too much of him at the end of that in Song of Achilles, but also he has lost all his ships but one. All his men have been killed. He's seen them, you know, eaten by a cyclops before his eyes. And so part of what I wanted to do with Odysseus is show, sort of highlight two things. Yes, he's still that same wily, clever, you know, person that we love. But he, you know, even he is worn down by the horrors of war and by the grief of what he has experienced. And even he is exhausted and affected and changed by all the violence he has seen. And the other thing that I wanted to highlight was that I think although Odysseus is would be a very fun person, I think, to hang out with, I think he would be a difficult person to live with.
Yeah.
And he is never content.
And that keeps filling him up and filling him up and filling him up until he has what happens in a lot of Greek plays and stories is he ends up having a fatal flaw.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what, you know, that's one of the things that I think, going back to why I love these stories so much, when we talk about heroes in our modern world, we often talk about heroes being moral exemplars, people who are very virtuous. But the ancient heroes were not like that. Ancient heroes, it's almost like it's more comparable to modern athletes. You know, they were extraordinary in what they did, but they also had incredible flaws. I mean, the whole Iliad is, in fact, built around, you know, Achilles' flaw, you might say. and what I wanted to do with Circe, since she is the center of the story, is I wanted her to have the same, you know, epic journey, flaws, strengths, virtues, weaknesses that the male heroes have been given.
Yeah, and it's funny, you talked briefly about Hermes, but, you know, I always used to think of him as, yes, the trickster, but kind of like a nice guy, but then he's more like in the Thor movies, like in Loki, he's more, you know, or in Star Wars, whoever that guy is. You know, you think you can trust him, you think till the very end, oh, maybe he's coming around to my side, but then he never really does come around to your side. He's just always in it for as long as, you know, once Circe becomes dull, she loses all meaning for him. You know, he's looking for this excitement.
Yeah, that was a fun character to imagine and write about, because I think he is so appealing, and so many of us, myself included, have found him a really appealing figure. But what would it be like to actually interact with him over the years? Certainly, he is not someone you can count on.
Yeah, and certainly Circe interacts with him in the most intimate of ways, but you know, she finally decides, you know, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. Kind of turns the tables, because he kind of then wants to, you know, but
well, I wanted her to, you know, have that experience of rejecting, and in some sense you see later with Odysseus that Odysseus actually is a descendant of Hermes. I think that the two of them are not dissimilar in some ways,
right?
You know, Odysseus is the human version, but he does have some of that kind of untouchable self-interest.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. That's what I was thinking of, the way you portrayed him in Song of Achilles. He was much more Hermes-like in there. He was much more.
Yeah, just, before he'd been beaten down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well done. you know, all the reviews talk about the empowerment of women in this story, which is true, but it's also true that you're not embellishing it. I mean, Circe did have power, and Penelope. Penelope's like, since she's not a goddess, she really just has a lot of common sense. She has a lot of forthrightness, some that she hides, but she's just a very powerful person. And she's an uplifting character.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, she's a very uplifting character, because in every situation, she's true.
Yes, and she... As I said, she was a character I was so much looking forward to. In the Odyssey, there is this incredibly telling moment where Odysseus has returned to Ithaca. You know, here's Penelope. She's been faithfully waiting for him for 20 years. And, you know, that is really something, particularly for the last 10 years, because all the other Greek, you know, the war was 10 years. Okay, I know he's at war. But then the 10 years to get home, it takes Odysseus 10 years to get home. All the other heroes have come back from the war, and he's still out there. And she has all these suitors who have gathered around the house and are besieging her constantly, saying, look, he's dead. He's not coming back. You have to pick one of us to, you know, to marry, and to increase the pressure on you, we're going to live in your house and you know, use up all your stores and threaten your son and just kind of be generally menacing and boorish. And she has, she, you know, continues under that incredible pressure to hold out hope for Odysseus. And so he does, in fact, come back, but he's in disguise, and he doesn't reveal himself to her. And there's a scene where she comes down and she talks to the suitors, and she says to them, all these men who've been living in her house, she says, okay, I will choose one of you, but you're all going about this the wrong way. You are not bringing me nearly enough stuff. You have to give me a lot more presents if I'm going to start thinking about choosing one of you. Because, of course, you know, so much of the ancient world is based on these sort of giving, the giving of presents as a way to, you know, bind people together socially and to win people over. And Odysseus watches this. And for a moment you think, oh, no, you know, is Odysseus going to think that she really is planning on choosing them? Is he going to be wounded? But Odysseus loves it, watching it, because he knows, he recognizes immediately what she's doing. He says, you know, she was tricking them with her honeyed words, with her charming words, while she was really thinking about other things. And we've talked a little bit about how Odysseus is very interested in treasure, so he loves that idea, that she's going to be bringing more treasure into the house. But it really, it's just this moment of recognition where he looks at her and he's like, I know exactly what you're doing because I do the same thing. And I think it really, to me, it said so much about their marriage, that they are kindred spirits. But even though they are kindred spirits, they're both tricky and clever, and they're able to manipulate people when they want to. They are not equals, because, you know, what would it be like to be that smart as a female and live the constricted life that women lived back then? You know, and so I wanted to explore some of that. Now, she and Odysseus are not exactly the same, but they do have that, you know, incredible intelligence. And, you know, I like the idea that they really loved each other, that there was something in each other that they really recognized also.
And then they create this son who has the best of both of their qualities, at least in the way
yes.
you portray him. Yeah.
Well, Telemachus was also a character I was so interested in writing about. I think it would be very hard to be the son of one of these heroes, or the daughter, but particularly the son, you know, in sort of the world of passing down, you know, the father passes down to the son. And one thing that I think has not really gotten enough attention as people look at these stories is the fact that Penelope is a single mother, and she raises Telemachus by herself for 20 years. And so, you know, then Odysseus comes back, but he's not really going to be like Odysseus. He's going to be like his mother, right? That's the, you know, there are aspects of Odysseus to him, but who's the parent who's raised him? It's not Odysseus. He wasn't there for any of that. And so I wanted to bring that aspect, you know, their relationship and her influence on him to the fore.
Yes. Hey, when you were a kid, was one of your favorite scenes with Odysseus pulling back his bow and shooting the arrow through all those axes and the holes in them? That was like my favorite.
It's such a great moment.
I know. It's like it's just a moment, too, but it like encapsulates so much.
But yeah, and it's the moment that's been building up. Like
yeah,
the
yeah.
whole poem has been building up to that moment. You know, the sewers have been so awful, and we've been waiting for Odysseus to get home, and finally he's here. He's got his bow there, and he's just going to, you know, here comes the vengeance, the justice raining down.
Yeah, and it's just like only he can use that bow. There's no one in the world that could shoot like that. He comes disguised as a beggar, so no one knows who he is. He throws back his cloak. It's just it's like the coolest thing. And,
I totally agree. It's really, it's an amazing moment. It's an amazing moment in the narrative. And what I love is you're so with him in that moment, you know, like, yes, get those suitors. They have really deserved this.
I can just see you as a little girl. I can just see you as a little girl.
Then it's followed up by another incredible moment, which is the moment where he and Penelope finally, finally reunite. And we see the husband and wife, you know, and Penelope, who's been very defended the whole time, you know, able to embrace her husband, and he able to embrace her in this emotional moment where they reconnect. And then the kind of final thing that happens is that the families of the suitors, and this is why I think Homer and these ancient stories are so brilliant, because it doesn't just end there. You know, we don't fade to black. We get this follow-up where the families of the suitors show up and they say, you slaughtered our children in your house. You know, that we're coming armed. We're going to demand, you know, that you make this right. We're going to attack you. You know, there's this big confrontation. And this is where I think things start to, you know, some people, myself included, have seen Odysseus as slightly less sympathetic, because Odysseus' instinct is to just kill them on the spot. You know, not to sort of say, here's why I killed your sons. Here's, you know, they deserve this. This was justice. I'm the king. His response is to just keep killing. And in fact, Athena has to come down and say, you know, that's it. No more bloodshed. It's a deus ex machina moment where the gods fix everything. And so there are just these three, as you say, the bow moment, the reunion with Penelope, and then this sort of frightening moment where it's like, well, how many people is Odysseus going to go on killing? You know, is he just going to keep on until there's no one who, you know, defies him anymore? So that's interesting too, and I think speaks to a little bit of that, you know, whether the ancients didn't have the word PTSD, but, you know, that the only way he can sort of think to respond is with extreme violence.
Yeah, it's very true. I never thought of it that way. And actually, yes, we're talking about something that I remember well. But then when you talk about, when you go into the relationship between Telemachus and Circe's son, I don't want to spoil that. It's just I didn't know anything about that. So where is that written? Is that right there in the pages? Because I don't remember it.
So again, not in the Odyssey, but the tradition that Odysseus and Circe had a child, or there are some traditions where they have multiple children. I didn't go with those. I just went with one child because it didn't really make sense. If he was only there for a year, that they could have like this whole litter of children that are different ages. So I just went with the one. They have one child. His name is Telegonus, which, you know, Telegonus, Telemachus. And there is a myth about him. He goes, when he's very young, he goes to try and find his father and get to know him. And he and Odysseus have this tragic misunderstanding where, you know, they don't recognize, I won't say more, but they have a tragic misunderstanding. But it was wonderful to write the character of Telegonus, because, you know, we always see Telemachus as an only child. You know, he's the only child of Penelope and Odysseus, and, you know, what would it be like to find out that you have a half-brother out there in the world when you have felt, you know, so alone for much of your life. So it was... there were just so many family dynamics at play. And in the myth that I'm referencing, what happens in my book really happens in the myth, which is Penelope and Telemachus come back to Circe's island with Telegonus, her son with Odysseus, and they're all on Circe's island. So I was following the myth for all of that.
And then they both children make choices that you might think would have been reversed. I remember I read this story once about this really wealthy man who had two sons, and one was good and one was evil. And when the man died, his will read that one son could have this gold platter that the father won when he was a younger man, and the other son would get the rest of the old man's wealth. And of course, the terrible son thought, oh no, I'm going to get the platter. And the good son took the platter rather than the money, and the bad son took the money. And he ended up, you know, wasting it.
Yeah. Well, the sort of the idea of what gets passed down. You know, who is the inheritor of Odysseus's legacy, and what is it like to carry that legacy? And I think both sons struggle with what that legacy means and how they fit in to their father's story. What ways they want to be like their father, and what ways they want to be like their mother, and all of that. So, and I think they both come up with very different answers, both from each other and from Odysseus's answer.
Yeah, I want to go back to this, but I was just thinking of something. In this one interview you did, you talked about Watership Down, and was it Richard Adams?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did you ever read The Girl in a Swing, one of the sequels, one of the books he wrote?
I did, a long time ago. So I'm so glad you brought this up, because I always have the chance to talk about Watership Down. So I read everything I think I've read everything he's ever written, because I love Watership Down so much. So I did read it, but I'm a little hazy on the details because it was a long time ago.
Well, the thing I was going to tell you was, part of it was set in Gainesville, Florida, which is where I used to live. And Richard Adams was living in the same apartment complex as I was. So I got to talk.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. So I got to talk to him a little bit about Watership Down. It was like one of the high points of my life.
But, that's amazing. So you talked to him in person?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, what was he like?
He was just a really nice person. And, of course, I was like starstruck. So I was telling him how much I loved the book, blah, blah, blah. But he was just a really nice person, kind of like... I wrote this letter to John Updike one time when I was reading his book when I was like 12 or 13, his book of short stories, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, you know, I don't understand some of these stories, because I didn't, because there was all the sexuality and stuff, and he wrote me back this nice postcard with had a 4-cent stamp on it, and he said, thank you very much for your letter. Perhaps a simple rereading of the stories might help. And I still have the postcard.
That's amazing. I was going to say, I hope you kept it.
I did. So am I pronouncing Galatea right, or is it Galatea?
Galatea. Is usually how I say it. But
so how did you end up doing that and doing it as a Kindle single and that? Because it was a great story. Did you ever read the story of The Yellow Wallpaper?
Yes, I love The Yellow Wallpaper.
It's very much like that, isn't it?
Yes, and I wanted it to be in that tradition. So unlike... both Song of Achilles and Circe are set very strongly in Homer's world. I take Homer's world for my world. So there are gods, but I also obey the kind of the rules of Homer's world. But for Galatea, I wanted to step a little bit outside that and set it in kind of a strange, alternate, part ancient, part modern setting. So it's a little bit more surreal, but... but yes, that it's kind of my homage to the Yellow Wallpaper.
That was an amazing book and a seminal book too for women, not necessarily in terms of empowerment, but in terms of being protagonists in their own lives.
Yes.
But
I remember reading that. I'm so glad you brought that up. I remember reading that in high school, and it was very significant to me when I read it, because I hadn't read a lot of stuff like that.
It scared me.
Yeah.
And your story kind of like you, which is really great when an author writes like this, your story leaves a lot of questions in the reader's mind, which will never be answered. So what are you going to do? Are you going to always, are you like so, I interviewed this guy who wrote Why Read Moby Dick. I forgot what his name is. Philbrook, something Philbrook. And, he was obsessed with Moby Dick, and like he said, whatever you want to know about today's world, you can find out about it in Moby Dick. And I was kind of saying, that's not really true. And he goes, yes, it is true. So is that the way you're going to be like? Is everything going to stick with the Iliad and the Odyssey? Or are you going to, because the story was great, and I can just see you writing tons of short stories like that.
You know, I think I don't plan to stay in the ancient world forever. I could, in fact, I, you know, who knows, life is long, and I may eat these words one day, but I actually don't see myself writing again in Homer's world. I could imagine possibly, I think I have sort of one more ancient idea that is possessing me as relates to Virgil's Aeneid, which is the other great ancient epic that I love and is, you know, very, very close to my heart. But I can also see myself writing contemporary fiction. I mentioned that Shakespeare is the other thing I love. There's a story about the Tempest that I would be interested in exploring. So I feel like these were the two stories that I really, really wanted to tell. And I think I need to be completely obsessed and possessed. And, you know, these were the two that took me over, and I think I might be moving away from Homer's world.
One more would be good, because it's, even though Mary Renault wrote more, there really was three books that really... And then you write about... And then you throw the Minotaur in, too. I mean, necessarily, but That was a great section of the book, too. The story of the Minotaur.
Well, thank you. If you have the opportunity to write about the Minotaur, I feel like as an author, you're obligated to take it.
Yeah, I know. I know. And the athletes who jumped on his horns and all that, you know, just the dancers.
Oh, yeah.
Those were great scenes in her books, but yeah.
Yes, well, it's such a great. I mean, there's so many ways to look at that story. You know, to look at it from the literal monster way, but also, you know, what it means allegorically, symbolic. I mean, there's so much rich stuff there. And Crete, ancient Crete, was a fascinating place because, you know, it's slightly different from. It's not Mycenaean culture; it's Minoan culture, and so it's a little bit different from. Sort of what we think of as typical Bronze Age Mycenaean, you know, Achilles and Odysseus. So there's a lot to explore there.
You could do like that guy did when he wrote that book, Grendel, telling the story from the monster's point of view, and you could tell the story from the Minotaur's point of view.
Yes. Well, I think the poor Minotaur has a very sad life.
Yeah.
You know, here it was a challenge to write Circe. One of the things that was challenging about Circe is, of course, that she spends a lot of the novel, well, not a lot, but, you know, a significant portion of the novel on her island. And people come and go, and she does leave on a few instances. But I think the Minotaur, that'd be even harder. He'd just be in the maze the whole time.
Yeah, have to be a very cerebral book. But
yeah, very cerebral, that's right. You have to be a very philosophical monster.
Well, I could go on forever, but, you know, we've been talking for 45 minutes, and I know you have things to do. So I just wanted to say I love both books, and I look forward to your next book. And also, I'm really happy that just for the listeners here and wherever you're listening, that you'll be out at our bookstore or perhaps if we get a large enough crowd at a larger venue on or about May 17th of this year. So that'll be great.
Thank you. I am so looking forward to it, and thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, it was
really
a pleasure. Yeah, it was fun.
And I love that you met Richard Adams.
Me too. Okay, see you later.
Okay, take care. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. So we were talking with Madeline Miller, author of Circe, which is a successor to The Song of Achilles, which won the Orange Prize. And she's going to be at the Wellington Square Bookshop on May 17th. So hopefully you'll join us there for her signing, talking, reading. And yeah, you know, she's a great author. It's two great books. I can't recommend for you, for your children, for young adults, two better books than The Song of Achilles and Circe, because they bring to light how alive the Greek works are and how important they still are. And, you know, a lot of people don't feel that way about the canon of literature in many situations, but having someone interpret it in this way without taking liberties and changing the story is great. And plus that short story that she wrote, Galatea, is a great way of bringing the past, the story of Pygmalion, into the present. So as always, Rebecca has gotten great guests. Upcoming guests we have include Christopher Moore, one of my favorite authors, to discuss his latest novel, Noir, N-O-I-R. Jody Shields will be here to share her most recent work, which is called The Winter Station. And Matt Young will share what seems to be the most buzzed about memoir this year called Eat the Apple. So join us for those and the rest of the ones that will be coming through May and this summer. And please stop by Wellington Square on May 17th or earlier to check our bookstore out and to meet with Madeline Miller. Thanks as always for joining us on The Avid Reader.